This is Audible.
Phoenix Audio presents Scar Tissue, written by Anthony Kiedis, read by Ryder Strong. Scar Tissue. Introduction. I'm sitting on the couch in the living room of my house in the Hollywood Hills. It's a clear, crisp January day, and from my vantage point, I can see the beautiful expanse known as the San Fernando Valley. When I was younger, I subscribed to the conventional wisdom shared by everyone who lived on the Hollywood side of the hills, that the valley was a place where the losers who couldn't make it in Hollywood went to disappear. But the longer I've lived here, the more I've come to appreciate the valley as a soulful and quieter side of the Los Angeles experience. Now I can't wait to wake up and look out on those majestic mountain ranges topped with snow. But the doorbell interrupts my reverie. A few minutes later, a beautiful young woman enters the living room, carrying an exquisite leather case. She opens it and begins to set up her equipment. Her preparations complete, she dons sterile rubber gloves and then sits next to me on the couch. Her elegant large glass syringe is handcrafted in Italy. It's attached to a spaghetti-shaped piece of plastic that contains a small microfilter so no impurities will pass into my bloodstream. The needle is a brand new, completely sterilized microfine butterfly variant. Today my friend has misplaced her normal medical tourniquet, so she pulls off her pink fishnet stocking and uses it to tie off my right arm. She dabs at my exposed vein with an alcohol swab, then hits the vein with the needle. My blood comes oozing up into the spaghetti-shaped tube, and then she slowly pushes the contents of the syringe into my bloodstream. I immediately feel the familiar weight in the center of my chest, so I just lie back and relax. I used to let her inject me 4 times in one sitting, but now I'm down to 2 syringes full. After she's refilled the syringe and given me my 2nd shot, she withdraws the needle, opens a sterile cotton swab, and applies pressure to my puncture wound for at least 1 minute to avoid bruising or marking on my arms. I've never had any tracks from her menstruations. Finally, she takes a little piece of medical tape and attaches the cotton to my arm. Then we sit and talk about sobriety. 3 years ago, there might have been China White heroin in that syringe. For years and years, I filled syringes and injected myself with cocaine, speed, black tar heroin, Persian heroin, and once even LSD. But today I get my injections from my beautiful nurse, whose name is Sathari. And the substance that she injects into my bloodstream is ozone, a wonderful smelling gas that has been used legally in Europe for years to treat everything from strokes to cancer. I'm taking ozone intravenously because somewhere along the line, I contracted hepatitis C from my drug experimentation. When I found out I had it, sometime in the early 90s, I immediately researched the topic and found an herbal regimen that would cleanse my liver and eradicate the hepatitis. And it worked. My doctor was shocked when my 2nd blood test came up negative. So the ozone is a preventative step to make sure that the pesky Hep C virus stays away. It took years and years of experience and introspection and insight to get to the point where I could stick a needle into my arm to remove toxins from my system as opposed to introducing them. But I don't regret any of my youthful indiscretions. I spent most of my life looking for the quick fix and the deep kick. I shot drugs under freeway off-ramps with Mexican gangbangers and in $1,000-a-day hotel suites. Now I sip vitamin-infused water and seek out wild as opposed to farm-raised salmon. For 20 years now, I've been able to channel my love for music and writing and tap into the universal slipstream of creativity and spirituality while writing and performing our own unique sonic stew with my brothers, both present and departed, in the Red Hot Chili Peppers. This is my account of those times, as well as the story of how a kid who was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, migrated to Hollywood and found more than he could handle at the end of the rainbow. This is my story, scar tissue and all. Chapter 1. Me, I'm from Michigan. I've been shooting coke for 3 days straight with my Mexican drug dealer, Mario, when I remembered the Arizona show. By then, my band, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, had 1 album out, and we were about to go to Michigan to record our 2nd album. But first, Lindy, our manager, had booked us a gig in a steakhouse disco in Arizona. The promoter was a fan of ours, and he was going to pay us more than we were worth, and we all needed the money, so we agreed to play. Except I was a wreck. I usually was whenever I went downtown and hooked up with Mario. Mario was an amazing character. He was a slender, wiry, and wily Mexican who looked like a slightly larger, stronger version of Gandhi. He wore big glasses, so he didn't look vicious or imposing, but whenever we shot coke or heroin, he'd make his confessions. I had to hurt somebody.
I'm an enforcer for the Mexican Mafia. I get these calls and don't even want to know the details. I just do my job, put the person out of commission, and get paid.
You never knew if anything he said was true. Mario lived in an old 8-story brick tenement downtown, sharing his squalid apartment with his ancient mother, who would sit in the corner of this itty-bitty living room, silently watching Mexican soap operas. Every now and then, there'd be outbursts of bickering in Spanish, and I'd ask him if we should be doing drugs there. He had a giant pile of drugs and syringes and spoons and tourniquets right on the kitchen table. "Don't worry, she can't see her here. She doesn't know what we're doing," he'd reassure me. So I'd shoot speedballs with Granny in the next room. Mario wasn't actually a retail drug dealer. He was a conduit to the wholesalers, so you'd get incredible bang for your buck, but then you'd have to share your drugs with them, which we were doing that day in his tiny kitchen. Mario's brother had just gotten out of prison, and he was right there with us, sitting on the floor and screaming each time that he tried and failed to find a working vein in his leg. It was the first time that I'd ever seen someone who had run out of useful real estate in his arms and was reduced to poking a leg to fix. We kept this up for days, even panhandling at one point to get some more money for coke. But now it was 4:30 in the morning, and I realized we had to play that night. "Okay, time to buy some dope, because I need to drive to Arizona today, and I don't feel so good," I decided. So Mario and I got into my cheesy little hunk of junk green Studebaker Lark and drove to a scarier, deeper, darker, less friendly part of the downtown ghetto than we were already in, a street that you just didn't want to even be on, except the prices here were the best. We parked and then walked a few blocks until we got to a run-down old building.
"Trust me, you don't want to go in," Mario told me. "Anything can happen inside there, and it's not going to be good, so just give me the money, and I'll get the stuff."
Part of me was going, "Jesus Christ, I don't want to get ripped off right now. He hasn't done it before, but I wouldn't put it past him." But the other, larger part of me, just wanted that heroin. So I pulled out the last $40 that I had stashed away and gave it to him, and he disappeared into the building. I'd been up shooting coke for so many days straight that I was hallucinating, in a strange limbo between consciousness and sleep. All I could think was that I really needed him to come out of that building with my drugs. I took off my prized possession, my vintage leather jacket. Years earlier, Flea and I had spent all our money on these matching leather jackets, and this jacket had become like a house to me. It stored my money and my keys and, in a nifty little secret pocket, my syringes. Now I was so wasted and chilly that I just sat down on the curb and draped my jacket over my chest and shoulders as if it were a blanket.
"Come on, Mario. Come on, you gotta come down now," I chanted my mantra.
I envisioned him leaving that building with a dramatically different pep in his step, going from the slumping, downtrodden guy to the skipping, "Whistle while you work, let's go shoot up guy." I just closed my eyes for an instant when I sensed a shadow coming over me. I looked over my shoulder and I saw a hulking, big, dirty, crazy-looking Mexican Indian coming at me with a huge, industrial-sized pair of cut-your-head-off giant scissors. He was in mid-stab, so I arched my back as forward as I could to get away from his thrust. But suddenly, a skinny little jack-o'-lantern Mexican bastard jumped in front of me, holding a menacing-looking switchblade. I made an instantaneous decision that I wasn't going to take it in the back from the big guy. I'd rather take my chances with the scarecrow killer in front of me. This was all happening so fast, but when you're faced with your own death, you go into that slow-motion mode where you get the courtesy of the universe expanding time for you. So I jumped up, and with my leather jacket in front of me, charged the skinny guy. I pushed the jacket onto him and smothered his stab, then dropped it and ran out of there like a Roman candle. I ran and I ran, and I didn't stop until I got to where my car was parked. But then I realized that I didn't have the keys. I had no keys, no jacket, no money, no syringes, and worst of all, no drugs. And Mario was not the kind of guy to come looking for me. So I walked back to his house, but nada. Now the sun had come up and we were supposed to leave for Arizona in an hour. I went to a payphone and found some change and called Lindy.
"Lindy, I'm down on 7th and Alvarado, and I haven't been asleep for a while, and my car is here, but I have no keys. Can you pick me up on the way to Arizona?"
He was used to these Anthony distress calls. So an hour later, there was our blue van pulling up to the corner, packed with our equipment and the other guys, and one deranged, sad, torn-up, filthy passenger climbed aboard. I immediately got the cold shoulder from the rest of the band, so I just lay down lengthwise under the bench seats, rested my head in the center column between the two front seats, and passed out. Hours later, I woke up drenched in sweat because I was lying on top of the engine and it was at least 115 degrees out. But I felt great. And Flea and I split a tab of LSD, and we rocked out that steakhouse. Most people probably view the act of conception as merely a biological function. But it seems clear to me that on some level, spirits choose their parents, because these potential parents possess certain traits and values that the soon-to-be child needs to assimilate during his or her lifetime. So 23 years before I'd wind up on the corner of 7th and Alvarado, I recognized John Michael Kiedis and Peggy Nobel as two beautiful but troubled people who would be the perfect parents for me. My father's eccentricity and creativity and anti-establishment attitude, coupled with my mother's all-encompassing love and warmth and hard-working consistency, were the optimal balance of traits for me. So, whether through my own volition or not, I was conceived on February 3, 1962, on a horribly cold and snowy night in a tiny house on top of a hill in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Actually, both of my parents were rebels, each in his or her own way. My dad's family had migrated to Michigan from Lithuania in the early 1900s. Anton Kiedis, my great-grandfather, was a short, stocky, gruff guy who ruled his household with an iron fist. In 1914, my granddad, John Alden Kiedis, was born, the last of five children. The family then relocated to Grand Rapids, where John went to high school and excelled in track. As a teen, he was an inspiring Bing Crosby-like crooner and an excellent amateur short story writer. Growing up in the Kiedis household meant that my granddad couldn't drink, smoke cigarettes, or swear. He never had a problem conforming to that strict lifestyle. Eventually, he met a beautiful woman named Molly Vandenveen, whose heritage was a pastiche of English, Irish, French, and Dutch, and, as we've recently discovered, some Mohican blood, which explains my interest in Native American culture and my identification with Mother Earth. My dad, John Michael Kiedis, was born in Grand Rapids in 1939. 4 years later, my grandparents divorced, and my dad went to live with his father, who worked in a factory that produced tanks for the war effort. After a few years, my granddad remarried, and my dad and his sister had a more conventional home life. But John Alden's tyranny was too much for my dad to bear. Dad had to work in the family businesses, a gas station and then a drive-in burger joint. He couldn't play with his friends, he couldn't stay up late, he couldn't even think about drinking or smoking cigarettes. On top of that, his stepmom, Eileen, was a devout Dutch Reformed Christian who made him go to church 5 times during the week and 3 times on Sunday, experiences that later embittered him towards organized religion. By the time he was 14, he had run away from home, jumping a bus to Milwaukee, where he spent most of his time sneaking into movies and drinking free beer in the breweries. After a while, he returned to Grand Rapids and entered high school, where he met Scott St. John, a handsome, rakish ne'er-do-well who introduced my father to a life of petty crime. Hearing the stories of their exploits was always depressing to me, because they were so unsuccessful. One time they went to a nearby beach, stripped down to their boxer shorts in an attempt to blend in, and then stole someone's unattended wallet. But there was at least one witness to the crime, so there was an immediate APB on the beach for two guys in boxer shorts. They got nabbed and they had to spend the whole summer in jail. At the same time that Jack, as he was known then, and Scott were raising hell in Grand Rapids and beyond, Peggy Nobel was leading what looked like a life of conventional propriety. The youngest of a family of five, my mom was the embodiment of a Midwestern sweetheart, petite, brunette, and cuter than the Dickens. She was very close to her dad, who worked for Michigan Bell. She always described him as a sweetheart of a man, wonderful, loving, kind, and fun. Peggy wasn't as close to her mom, who, although brilliant and independent, followed the conventions of the day and eschewed college for life as an executive secretary, which probably made her a little bitter. And as the rigid disciplinarian of the family, she often clashed with my mom, whose rebellious attitude took some unconventional routes. My mom was enthralled with black music, listening almost exclusively to James Brown and then Motown. She was also enthralled with the star athlete of her high school class, who just happened to be black, a pretty taboo romance for the Midwest in 1958. Enter Jack Kiedis, freshly back in Grand Rapids from a jailhouse stay for a burglary in Ohio. His sidekick Scott was stewing in the Kent County Jail for a solo caper, so my dad was on his own when he went to a party in East Grand Rapids one night in May of 1960. He was reconnoitering the talent when he looked down a hallway and caught a glimpse of a small, dark-haired angel wearing white-fringed Indian moccasins. Smitten, he jostled people and rushed to the spot where he'd seen her, but she was gone. He spent the rest of the night trying to find her, but he was content just to learn her name. A few nights later, Jack showed up on Peggy's porch, dressed up in a sport jacket and pressed jeans, holding a huge bouquet of flowers. She agreed to a date to see a movie. 2 months later, after obtaining permission from her parents, the still 17-year-old Peggy married Jack, who was 20, on the day before her parents' 35th anniversary. Scott St. John was the best man. 6 weeks later, Peggy's dad died from complications of diabetes. A few weeks after that, my dad started cheating on my mom. By the end of that year, somehow Jack convinced Peggy to let him take their brand new blue Austin Healey and, along with his friend John Reeser, drive to Hollywood. Reeser wanted to meet Annette Funicello, and my dad wanted to be discovered and become a movie star. But most of all, he didn't want to be tied down to my mom. After a few months of misadventures, the two friends settled in San Diego, until Jack got word that Peggy was seeing a man who had a monkey back in Grand Rapids. Insanely jealous, he drove 100 miles per hour without stopping and moved back in with my mom, who was just innocent friends with the primate owner. A few weeks later, convinced that he'd made a huge mistake, Jack moved back to California. And for the next year, my parents alternated between being married and being separated, and between being in California and being in Michigan. One of those reconciliations led to an arduous bus ride from sunny California to freezing Michigan. The next day, I was conceived. I was born in St. Mary's Hospital in Grand Rapids, 5 hours into November 1, 1962, just shy of 7.5 pounds, 21 inches long. I was nearly a Halloween baby, but being born on November 1st is even more special to me. In numerology, the number one is such a potent number that to have three ones all in a row is a pretty good place to start your life. My mom wanted to name me after my dad, which would have made me John Kiedis III, but my dad was leaning toward Clark Gable Kiedis or Courage Kiedis. In the end, they settled on Anthony Kiedis, which was an homage to my great-grandfather. But from the start, I was known as Tony. I left the hospital and joined my dad, my mom, and their dog, Panzer, in their tiny new government-funded home in the country outside of Grand Rapids. But within weeks, my dad started getting wanderlust and cabin fever. In January 1963, my granddad, John Kiedis, decided to uproot the entire family and move to the warmer climates of Palm Beach, Florida. So he sold his business and packed up the U-Haul and took his wife and six children, plus my mom and me. I don't remember living in Florida, but my mom said it was a pleasant time, once we got out from under the yoke of the abusive patriarch of the Kiedis family. After working at a laundromat and saving some money, my mom found a little apartment over a liquor store in West Palm Beach, and we moved in. When she got a bill for 2 months' rent from Grandpa Kiedis, she promptly wrote him, "I forwarded your bill to your son. I hope you hear from him soon." Mom was working for Honeywell by then, pulling in $65 a week, 1 week's worth of that going towards our rent. For another $10 a week, I was in daycare. According to my mom, I was a very happy baby. Meanwhile, my dad was alone at his empty house in the country. Coincidentally, the wife of one of his best friends had left him, so the two buddies decided to move to Europe. Dad just left the house with his car still in the garage, packed up his golf clubs, his typewriter, and the rest of his meager possessions, and took off for Europe on the SS France. After a wonderful 5-day trip that included the conquest of a young French woman married to a Jersey cop, my dad and his friend Tom settled in Paris. By then, Jack had grown his hair long, and he felt simpatico with the beatniks on the left bank. They had a pleasant few months, writing poetry and sipping wine in smoke-filled cafes, but they ran out of money. They hitchhiked up to Germany, where they were inducted into the army to get free passage back to the States on a troop ship. They were packed in like sardines, tossed around on turbulent seas and dodging vomit along with insults like, "Hey, Jesus, get a haircut!" That ride home was the worst experience of my father's life. Somehow, he convinced my mother to let him move back in with her again. After her mother died in a tragic car crash, we all moved back to Michigan in late 1963. By now, my father was determined to follow the lead of his friend John Reeser and enroll in junior college, ace all his courses, and get a scholarship to a good university, and ultimately get a good job and be in a better position to raise a family. For the next 2 years, that was exactly what he did. He finished junior college and got many scholarship offers, but decided to accept a scholarship from UCLA, go to film school, and realize his dream of living in Los Angeles. In July 1965, when I was 3 years old, we moved to California. I have some vague recollections of the first apartment that the three of us shared, but in under a year, my parents had once again split up, once again, over other women. My mom and I moved into an apartment on Ohio Street, and she found a job as a secretary at a law firm. Even though she was in the straight world, she always maintained that she was a closet hippie. I do remember her taking me to Griffith Park on the weekends to a new form of social expression called love-ins. The verdant rolling hills were filled with little groups of people picnicking and stringing love beads and dancing. It was all very festive. Every few weeks, my routine would be interrupted by a special treat when my dad came to pick me up and take me on outings. We'd go to the beach and climb down on the rocks, and my dad would put his pocket comb out, and all these crabs would grab it. Then we'd catch starfish. I'd take them home and try to keep them alive in a bucket of water at my house, but they'd soon die and stink up the entire apartment. In each of our ways, we were all prospering in California, especially my dad. He was having a creative explosion at UCLA and using me as the focal point of all his student films. Because he was my father, he had a special way of directing me, and the films all wound up winning competitions. The first film, A Boy's Expedition, was a beautiful meditation on a 2.5-year-old who rides his tricycle down the street, does a big slow-motion wipeout, and lands on a dollar bill. For the rest of the film, I go on a wild ride through downtown LA, going to the movies, buying comic books, taking bus rides, and meeting people, thanks to that buck I found. In the end, it all turns out to be a fantasy sequence, as I pocket the bill and ride off on my tricycle. My dad's budding career as a director got derailed in 1966, when he ran into a cute young roller skating car hop who introduced him to pot. When I was about 4, my dad and I were on one of our outings, walking down Sunset Strip, when he suddenly stopped and gently blew some pot smoke into my face. We walked a few more blocks, and I was getting more and more excited. Then I stopped and asked, "Dad, am I dreaming?"
"No, you're awake," he said.
"Okay." I shrugged and proceeded to scamper up a traffic light post like a little monkey, feeling slightly altered. Once my dad got into pot, he started hanging out at the music clubs that were part of the new scene on Sunset Strip. Correspondingly, we saw less and less of him. Each summer, my mom and I returned to Grand Rapids to see our relatives. Grandma Molly and her husband Ted would take me to Grand Haven Beach, and we'd have a great time. During that stay in the summer of 1967, my mom ran into Scott St. John at Grand Haven. After they spent some time together, he talked her into returning to Michigan with him in December 1967. The move wasn't all that traumatic, but Scott coming into the picture was definitely disturbing. There was nothing calming or soothing or comforting about this chaotic character. He was big and tough and swarthy and mean with black, greasy hair. I knew that he worked at a bar and that he got into a lot of fights. One time I woke up early in the morning and went into my mom's room and he was lying on the bed. His face was just obliterated, with black eyes and a bloody nose and a split lip and cuts. Blood was everywhere. My mom was putting ice on one part of his head and cleaning up the blood off another part of his face and telling him he should probably go to the hospital. He was just being gruff and gnarly and mean. It was unsettling, knowing that my mom was in love with this guy. I knew he had been a friend to someone in the family, but I didn't realize that he was my dad's best friend. Scott had a short fuse and a big temper, and he was physically volatile. It was the first time in my life that I had received pretty hardcore spankings. One time I decided that I didn't like the tag in the back of my favorite blue jacket because it was itchy. It was pitch black in my room, but I knew where the scissors were, so I went to cut the tag out, and I ended up cutting a huge hole in the coat. The next day, Scott saw the hole, pulled down my pants, and spanked me with the back of a brush. So it was a rough little patch there. We were living on a very poor side of Grand Rapids, and I entered a new school to finish kindergarten. Suddenly, I stopped caring about learning, and I became a little rogue. I remember walking across the schoolyard and just cursing wildly at age 5, stringing together 40 curse words in a row, trying to impress my new friends. A teacher overheard me and called a parent-teacher conference, and I started developing the mentality that authority figures were against me. Another manifestation of my emotional discombobulation was the Slim Jim episode. I was with a friend of mine, and we had no money, so I stole some Slim Jims from a candy store. The owner called my mom. I can't remember my punishment, but shoplifting Slim Jims wasn't the average thing for a 6-year-old boy to do in Grand Rapids. In June 1968, my mom married Scott St. John. I was the ring bearer, and at the reception, I got a purple Stingray bicycle as a gift, which elated me. Now I equated their marriage with a great bicycle that had training wheels. There was a stretch around this time when I didn't see very much of my father, because he had gone to London and become a hippie. But every now and then I'd get packages from England stuffed with t-shirts and love beads. He'd write me long letters and tell me about Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and all these different bands he was seeing and how great the English girls were. It was like my dad was on some kind of psychedelic Disneyland ride off in the world, and I was stuck in snowy-ass Nowheresville, USA. I knew that there was this magic out there in the world, and that my father was somehow the key to it. But I also, especially in retrospect, enjoyed growing up in a calmer clime. That summer, I went out to California for a few weeks to see my dad, who had returned from London. He had an apartment on Hilldale in West Hollywood, but we spent a lot of time in Topanga Canyon, where his girlfriend Connie had a house. Connie was a fantastic character with a huge shock of flowing red hair, alabaster skin, really beautiful and crazy as could be. Besides Connie, my dad's friends were all these quintessential, drug-saturated, hippie cowboys. There was David Weaver, a non-stop-talking, huge man with shoulder-length hair, a handlebar mustache, and basic California hippie attire, not quite as stylish as my dad. He was a brutal brawler who fought like a Wolverine. The last corner of my dad's triangle was Alan Bashara, a former Vietnam vet who sported a huge afro and a big, bushy mustache. Bashara wasn't a macho, tough guy hippie. He was more the Georgie Jessel of the group, spewing a mile-a-minute comic shtick. So with David, the cool, tough, fighting guy, my dad, the creative, intellectual, romantic guy, and Alan, the comedian, it was working for all of them, and there was no shortage of women, money, drugs, and fun. It was round-the-clock partying with these guys. Weaver and Bashara had a house near Connie's, and they ran a rather enormous marijuana business out of Topanga Canyon. When I first got there, I didn't realize all this. All I saw was a lot of people constantly smoking pot. But then I walked into a room, and Weaver was sitting there counting stacks of money. I could tell that the vibe was very serious. I thought, okay, don't even know if I want to be in this room because they're doing math. So I went into the next room, where there was a small mountain of marijuana on top of huge tarps. Connie would constantly have to come get me and take me out to play in the canyon. It was, don't go into that room! Don't go into this room! Keep an eye out! Make sure no one's coming! There was always the element of suspense that we were doing something we might get caught for, which would give a kid some worry. But at the same time, it's like, what's going on in there? Why do you guys have so much money? What are all these pretty girls doing everywhere? I do remember having a sense of concern for my dad. At one point, some friends of his were moving from one house to another, and they filled this big open truck with all their possessions. My dad jumped up and rode on top of the mattress, which was precariously balanced on top of all the other belongings. We started moving, and we were careening down these canyon roads, and I was looking at my dad, barely holding onto the mattress, going, Dad, don't fall off!
Oh, don't you worry, he said.
But I did. That was the beginning of a theme, because for many years to come, I'd be scared to death for my dad's life. But I remember having a lot of fun, too. My dad and Connie and Weaver and Bashara would all go to the Corral, a little shit-kicker bar in the middle of Topanga Canyon where Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles and Neil Young played regularly. I'd go with the adults, and I'd be the only kid in the crowd. Everyone would be wasted, drinking and drugging, but I'd be out on the floor, dancing away. When I got back to Michigan, things hadn't changed much. First grade was pretty uneventful. My mom worked days as a secretary at a law firm, and after school I'd stay with a babysitter. But my life took a decided turn for the better in the fall of 1969, when we moved to Paris Street. We'd been living in a real poor, white trash section of the city, with lots of quadruplexes and shanty towns, but Paris Street was like something out of a Norman Rockwell painting. Single-family houses and manicured lawns and neat, clean garages. By now, Scott was mostly out of the picture, but he had stayed around long enough to impregnate my mother. Suddenly, I had a trio of beautiful young teenage girls watching me after school. At age 7, I was a little too young to be having crushes, but I adored these girls in a sisterly way, in awe of their beauty and their budding womanhood. I couldn't have been happier to spend time with them, whether it was watching TV or swimming in the local pool or going for walks in the small wildlands in the area. They introduced me to Plaster Creek, which would become my secret stomping grounds for the next 5 years. A sanctuary from the adult world where my friends and I could disappear into the woods and make boats and catch crawfish and jump off bridges into the water. So it was definitely a huge relief to move into that neighborhood where everything seemed nicer and where flowers grew. I even liked school. Whereas my previous school seemed dark and dismal and dreary, Brookside Elementary was a pleasant-looking building that had beautiful grounds and athletic fields that ran beside Plaster Creek. I wasn't as J.C. Penney as the rest of my classmates, because we were on welfare after my mom gave birth to my sister, Julie. So I was wearing whatever hand-me-downs we'd get from the local charitable institutions, with the occasional Liverpool Rules t-shirt I'd get from my dad. It didn't really register that we were on welfare until about a year later, when we were at the grocery store and everyone else was paying in cash, but my mom broke out this Monopoly money for the groceries. Being on welfare bothered her, but I was never fazed by that so-called stigma. Living with a single parent and seeing that all my friends had mothers and fathers in the same house didn't make me envious. My mom and I were actually having a blast, and when Julie came into the picture, I couldn't have been happier to have a baby sister. I was really protective of her, until a few years later, when she became a subject of many of my experiments and torture. By the third grade, I developed real resentment towards the school administration. Because if anything went wrong, if anything was stolen, if anything was broken, if a kid was beaten up, they would routinely pull me out of the class. I was probably responsible for 90% of the mayhem, but I quickly became a proficient liar and cheat and scam artist to get out of the majority of the trouble. So I was bitter, and I'd get these ludicrous ideas such as, what if we detach the metal gymnastic rings that hang next to those swings, use them like a lasso, and put them right through the picture window of the school? My best friend, Joe Walters, and I snuck out of the house late one night and did it. And when the authorities came, we scampered like foxes down to Plaster Creek and never got caught. Many, many years later, I sent Brookside an anonymous money order for the damages. My problem with authority figures increased as I got older. I couldn't stand the principals, and they couldn't stand me. I had loved my teachers up until fifth grade. They were all women and kind and gentle, and I think they recognized my interest in learning and my capacity to go beyond the call of scholastic duty at that stage. But by fifth grade, I'd turned on all the teachers, even if they were great. By now, there was no male figure in my life to rein in any of this antisocial behavior, as if any of the males in my life would have. When my sister Julie was 3 months old, the police started staking out our house looking for Scott, because he had used some stolen credit cards. One night they came to the door, and my mom sent me to the neighbors while they interrogated her. Weeks later, Scott showed up and came storming into the house in a complete violent rage. He'd found out that someone had called my mom and told her he'd been cheating on her, so he rushed over to the phone in the living room and pulled it out of the wall. I started shadowing him every inch, because my mom was terrified, and I wasn't having any of that. He started to go into my room to get my phone, but I threw myself in front of him. I don't think I was too successful, but I was prepared to fight him, using all the techniques that he had taught me a few years earlier. My mom finally sent me next door to get the neighbors, but that was clearly the end of his welcome in that house. Still, about a year later, he attempted to reconcile with my mother. She flew to Chicago with little Julie, but he never showed up at the rendezvous spot. The cops had busted him. She had no money to get back home, but the airlines were nice enough to fly her back free. We went to visit him at a hardcore maximum security prison, and I found it fascinating, but a little disconcerting. On the way home, my mom said, "That's a first, and that's a last." And shortly after that, she divorced him. Lucky for her, she worked for lawyers, so it didn't cost her anything. Meanwhile, my admiration for my dad was growing exponentially. I couldn't wait for those 2 weeks every summer when I'd fly out to California and be reunited with him. He was still living on the top floor of a duplex house on Hilldale. Every morning I'd get up early, but my dad would sleep until about 2 p.m. after a late night of partying, so I had to find a way to entertain myself for the first half of the day. I'd go around the apartment to see what there was to read, and on one of my searches, I came across his huge collection of Penthouse and Playboy magazines. I just devoured them. I even read the articles. I had no sense that these were dirty magazines or in any way taboo, because he wouldn't come out and say, "Oh God, what are you doing with those?" He'd be more likely to come over, check out what I was looking at, and say, "Isn't that girl incredibly sexy?" He was always willing to treat me like an adult, so we talked openly and freely about the female genitalia and what to expect when I ended up going there. His bedroom was in the back of the house, next to a tree, and I remember him explaining his early warning system and escape plan. If the cops ever came for him, he wanted me to stall them at the front door so he could jump out the bedroom window, shimmy down the tree to the top of the garage, go down the house behind the garage to the apartment building, then on to the next street. That was confusing to me at 8 years old. How about if we just don't have the cops at the front door? But he told me that he had been busted for possession of pot a few years earlier, and he'd also been beaten up by cops just for having long hair. All that scared the pants off of me. I certainly didn't want my dad beaten up. All this only reinforced my distaste for authority. Even though I had concerns about my dad's well-being, those trips to California were the happiest, most carefree, the world is a beautiful oyster times I had ever experienced. I went to my first live music concerts and saw artists like Deep Purple and Rod Stewart. We'd go to see Woody Allen movies and even an R-rated movie or two. And then we'd sit around the house watching all those great psychedelic TV shows like The Monkees and the Banana Splits Adventure Hour, a show that featured these guys dressed up like big dogs driving little cars and going on adventures. That's how I looked at life at that time. Psychedelic, fun, full of sunshine, everything's good. Every so often, my dad would make an unscheduled visit to us in Michigan. He'd show up with a lot of heavy suitcases, which he stored in the basement. I realized from my trips to California that he was involved in moving huge truckloads of marijuana, but it never registered that when he came to visit, that was what he was up to. I was just euphoric that he was there. And he couldn't have been more different from every other person in the state of Michigan. Everyone on my block, everyone I'd ever come into contact with there, wore short hair and short-sleeved button-down shirts. My dad would show up in 6-inch silver platform snakeskin shoes with rainbows on them, bell-bottom jeans with crazy velvet patchwork all over them, giant belts covered in turquoise, skin-tight, almost midriff t-shirts with some great emblem on them, and tight little velvet rocker jackets from London. His slightly receding hair was down to his waist, and he had a huge, bushy handlebar mustache and huge sideburns. My mom didn't exactly embrace my dad as a good friend, but she recognized how important he was to me, so she was always pleasant and facilitated our communication. He would stay in my room, and when he left, she would sit down with me and I would write him thank you notes for whatever presents he'd brought me and tell him how much fun it was to see him. By the 5th grade, I had begun to show some entrepreneurial talent. I'd organize the neighborhood kids and we'd put on shows in my basement. I'd pick out a record, usually by the Partridge Family, and we'd all act out the songs using makeshift instruments like brooms and upside-down laundry tubs. I was always Keith Partridge, and we'd lip-sync and dance around and entertain the other kids who weren't quite capable of partaking in the performance. Of course, I was always looking to make a buck or two. So one time, when we had the use of a friend's basement, I decided that I would charge whatever these kids could come up with, a dime, a nickel, a quarter, to come down to my friend's basement and attend a Partridge Family concert. I set up a big curtain and put a stereo behind it. Then I addressed the crowd. "The Partridge Family are basically shy. And besides, they're much too famous to be in Grand Rapids, so they're going to play a song for you from behind this curtain." I went behind the curtain and pretended to have a conversation with them. Then I played the record. All the kids in the audience were going, "Are they really back there?" "Oh, they're there, and they've got someplace else to go, so you guys get running now," I said. I actually got a handful of change out of the deal. During 5th grade, I also devised a plan to get back at the principals and the school administrators I despised, especially since they had just suspended me for getting my ear pierced. In a school government class one day, the teacher asked, "Who wants to run for class president?" My hand shot up. "I'll do it," I said. Then another kid raised his hand. I shot him a look of intimidation, but he kept insisting he wanted to run. So we had a little talk about it after class. I told him that I was going to be the next class president, and if he didn't bow out immediately, he just might get hurt. So I became the president. The principal was dismayed beyond belief. I was now in charge of assemblies, and whenever we had special dignitaries come to the school, I was the one who showed them around. Sometimes I'd rule by intimidation, and often I'd get into fights at school. But I also had a tender side. Brookside was an experimental school with a special program that integrated blind and deaf and mildly retarded older kids into the regular classes. As much of a hooligan and an intimidator as I was, all of these kids became my friends. And since kids can be evil and torment anyone who's in any way different, these special students took a beating at every recess and lunchtime, so I became their self-imposed protector. I was keeping an eye on the blind girl while the deaf guy was stuttering, and if any of the jerk-offs teased them, I'd sneak up behind the offender with a branch and brain them. It definitely had my own set of morals. In 6th grade, I started coming home for lunch, and my friends would congregate there. We'd play spin the bottle, and even though we had our own girlfriends, swapping was never a problem. Mostly we just French kissed. Sometimes we'd designate the time that the kiss had to last. I tried to get my girlfriend to take off her training bra and let me feel her up, but she wouldn't give in. Somewhere late in the 6th grade, I decided that it was time to go live with my dad. My mom was at her wit's end with me, clearly losing all control. When I wasn't given the green light to go live with him, I started to really resent her. One night she sent me to my room, probably for talking back to her. I don't think I even grabbed anything. I went straight out of my bedroom window to make my way to the airport, call my father, and figure out a way to get on a plane and go straight to L.A. None of the flights went straight to L.A., but I didn't know that. I never even made it as far as the airport. I ended up at the house of one of my mom's friends a few miles away, and she called up my mom and took me home. That was the point at which my mother started considering letting me go. A big factor in the final decision was the entrance into her life of Steve Idema. Since Scott St. John had gone to jail, my mother decided that maybe her idea of reforming bad boys wasn't such a good one. Steve was a lawyer who provided legal aid for the impoverished. He had been a VISTA volunteer working with poor people in the Virgin Islands. He was a totally honest, hard-working, compassionate, stand-up fellow with a heart of gold, and my mom was crazy about him. As soon as I realized that he was a good guy and that they loved each other, I began lobbying harder to go to California and live with my dad. Chapter 2. Spider and Son. When I left Michigan at 12 years old in 1974, I told all my friends that I was moving to California to be a movie star. But as soon as I started driving around with my dad and his Healy, singing along to the pop songs on the radio, which I wasn't particularly good at, I announced, "I'm going to be a singer. That's really what I'm going to do." Even though I verbalized it, I didn't think about that vow for years. I was too busy falling in love with California. For the first time in my life, I felt like this was where I was supposed to be. It was palm trees and Santa Ana winds and people I liked looking at and talking to and hours I liked keeping. I was forging a friendship with my dad that was growing by leaps and bounds every day. He thought it was great because he had this young guy who could handle himself, whom all his friends and girlfriends loved. I wasn't slowing him down in the slightest. If anything, I was giving him a new prop. So it was working to our mutual benefit. And I was going through the roof with new experiences. Some of the most memorable of those new experiences happened right in my dad's little bungalow on Palm Avenue. He lived in one half of a house that had been split into two units. It had a quaint kitchen and wallpaper that was probably from the 30s. There were no bedrooms per se, but my father converted a small add-on storage room into a bedroom for me. It was all the way at the back of the house, and you had to go through a bathroom to get to it. My dad's bedroom was the den, a room that was enclosed by three swinging doors that led to the living room, the kitchen, and the bathroom. It had nice black wallpaper with big flowers and a window that looked into the side yard, which was teeming with morning glories. I had been there only a few days when my dad called me into the kitchen. He was sitting at the table with a pretty 18-year-old girl he'd been hanging out with that week. "Do you want to smoke a joint?" he asked me. Back in Michigan, I automatically would have answered no, but being in this new environment made me adventurous. So my dad got out a thick black American Heritage dictionary box. He opened the box, and it was full of weed. Using the lid as a preparation area, he broke off some of the pot, letting the seeds roll down to the bottom of the lid. Then he took out some rolling papers and showed me exactly how to roll a perfectly formed joint. I found the whole ritual fascinating. Then he lit up a joint and passed it to me.
"Be careful. Don't take too much. You don't want to cough your lungs out," he counseled.
I took a little drag and then passed the joint back to him. It went around the table a few times, and soon we were all smiling and laughing and feeling really mellow. And then I realized I was high. I loved the sensation. It felt like medicine to soothe the soul and awaken the senses. There was nothing awkward or scary. I didn't feel like I had lost control. In fact, I felt like I was in control. Then my dad handed me an Instamatic camera and said,
"I think she wants you to take some pictures of her."
I instinctively knew that some form of skin was about to be exposed. So I said to her, "What if we pull up your shirt and I'll take a picture of you?"
"That's a good idea, but I think it might be more artistic if you just had her expose one of her breasts," my dad said. We all concurred.
I took some pictures, and no one felt uncomfortable about it. So my entry into the world of pot smoking was as smooth as silk. The next time I smoked, I was already a pro, rolling the joint with an almost anal precision. But I didn't become fixated on it, even though my father was a daily pot smoker. For me, it was just another unique California experience. My first priority that fall was to get into a good junior high school. I was supposed to enroll in Bancroft, but when we went to check it out, we saw that the building was in a shady neighborhood and scarred with all sorts of gang graffiti. The place just didn't scream out, "Let's go to school and have fun here." So my dad drove us to Emerson, which was in Westwood. It was a classic California Mediterranean building with lush lawns and flowering trees and an American flag waving proudly in the breeze. Plus, everywhere I looked, there were these hot little 13-year-olds walking around in their tight ditto jeans. "Whatever it takes, I want to go here," I said. What it took was using Sonny Bono's Bel Air address as my home address. Connie had left my dad for Sonny, who had recently split with Cher. But everyone stayed friendly, and I'd met Sonny on my previous visit, and he was fine with the deception, so I enrolled. Now I had to find a way to get to school. If I took a city bus, it was a straight shot, 4.2 miles down Santa Monica Boulevard. The problem was the RTA was on strike. My dad was established in his routine of staying up late, getting up late, being high most of the time, and entertaining women all the time, so he wasn't exactly going to be a soccer mom and drive me to and from school. His solution was to leave a $5 bill on the kitchen table for a cab. Getting home would be my project. To facilitate that, he bought me a Black Knight skateboard, which had a wooden deck and clay wheels. So I'd skateboard and hitchhike or walk the 4 miles home, all the time discovering Westwood and Beverly Hills and West Hollywood. I went through almost all my first day at Emerson without making a friend. I started getting worried. Everything seemed new and daunting. Coming from a small Midwestern school, I wasn't exactly an academic. But at the end of the day, I had a creative arts class, and there was a friend waiting to happen. Sean, a black kid with bright eyes and the biggest smiles. It was one of those times when you march up to someone and say, "Do you want to be my friend?" "Yeah, I'll be your friend." Boom, you're friends. Going to Sean's house was an adventure. His dad was a musician, which was a new one for me, a dad who went out to the garage and practiced music with friends. Sean's mom was as warm and loving as could be, always welcoming me into the house and offering me some exotic food as an after-school snack. I had come from the most clueless area of the world when it came to cuisine. My culinary world consisted of things like white bread and Velveeta and ground beef. Here, they were eating yogurt and drinking a strange substance called kefir. Where I came from, it was Tang and Kool-Aid. But the education was a two-way street. I taught Sean a new pickpocketing technique I invented that semester, something I called the bump. I would target a victim and walk up to him and bump into him, making certain I had bumped him right on the object that I had coveted. It might be a wallet or a comb, whatever. It usually wasn't anything over a few dollars value, because that was what most kids had. My antisocial behavior at school continued unabated at Emerson. The minute someone would confront me in any way, even just telling me to get out of the way, I would pop him. I was a tiny fellow, but I was a quick draw, so I soon became known as the guy you didn't want to fuck with, and I'd always come up with a good story to avoid being suspended after a fight. Perhaps one of the reasons I didn't want to get suspended was that I would have let down one of the few conventional positive role models in my life at the time, Sonny Bono. Sonny and Connie had become surrogate parental figures to me. The Sonny and Cher show was probably the biggest thing on television then, and Sonny was always generous about ensuring that I'd get whatever extra care I needed. There was always a room for me in his mansion in Holmby Hills, and an attentive, around-the-clock staff to cook whatever I desired. He lavished gifts on me, including a brand new set of skis and ski boots and poles and a jacket so I could go skiing that winter with him and Connie and Chastity, Sonny's daughter with Cher. We would sit on the chairlift, and Sonny would give me his version of life, which was different from my father's or even Connie's version of life. He definitely was on the straight and narrow. I remember him teaching me that the only unacceptable thing was to tell a lie. It didn't matter if I'd made mistakes or fucked up along the way, I just had to be straight with him. One time I was at his Bel Air mansion during a star-studded Hollywood party. I didn't care about the Tony Curtises of the world at that point, so I started going up and down in the mansion's old carved wood elevator. Suddenly, I got stuck between floors, and they had to use a giant fireman's axe to free me. I knew I was in big trouble. But Sonny never screamed at me or demeaned me in front of all the adults who were watching this rescue. He just calmly taught me a lesson to respect other people's property and not play in things that weren't made to be played in. I never liked that there might be some expectation of how I should behave in order to be in that world. I was a 12-year-old kid, destined to be misbehaving and out of line. One time later that year, we were hanging around the house, and Sonny and Connie asked me to get them coffee. "How about if you guys got your own coffee?" I answered somewhat flippantly. I had no problem getting the coffee, but it seemed to me that they were bossing me around. Connie took me aside. "That's curbside behavior," she told me. "If you act that way, I'm just going to say curbside, and you'll know that you have to go and rethink what you just did." Forget that. Where I was coming from, I could act however I wanted. My dad and I were getting along famously precisely because there were no rules and no regulations. He wasn't asking me to get him any coffee, and I wasn't asking him to get me coffee. It was take care of yourself where I came from. I was growing up quickly, and in a way that definitely wasn't Sonny-friendly. More and more, I was getting high and partying with my friends and skateboarding and committing petty crimes. All the stuff I wasn't supposed to do was the stuff I wanted to do immediately. I had my eye on the prize, and I wasn't really hanging out with Sonny. So we grew apart. I was okay with that. Correspondingly, my bond with my dad got stronger and stronger. As soon as I had moved in with him, he instantly became my role model and my hero, so everything I could do to bolster the solidarity between us was my mission. It was also his. We were a team. Naturally, one of our bonding experiences was to go together on his pot-smuggling escapades. I became his cover for these trips. We'd take 7 giant Samsonite suitcases and fill them up with pot. At the airport, we'd go from one airline to another, checking in these bags, because at that time, they didn't even look to see if you were on the flight. We'd land at a major airport, collect all the suitcases, and drive to someplace like Kenosha, Wisconsin. On our Kenosha trip, we checked into a motel, because my dad's transactions were going to take a couple of days. I was adamant that I wanted to go with him when the deal went down, but he was dealing with badass biker types, so he sent me to a movie, which turned out to be the new James Bond flick, Live and Let Die. The transactions took place over a 3-day weekend, so I wound up going to that movie every day we were there, which was fine with me. We had to return to LA with $30,000 in cash. My dad told me I'd be carrying the money, because if they caught someone who looked like him with all that money, he'd be busted for sure. That was fine with me. I'd much prefer to be part of the action than be sitting on the sidelines. So we rigged a belt piece, stuffed it with the cash, and taped it to my abdomen.
If they try to arrest me, you just fade away, he instructed me. Just pretend you're not with me and keep on going.
We made it back to L.A., and I later found out that my dad was only getting $200 a trip to mule that pot for his friends Weaver and Bashara. I also discovered that he was supplementing that meager income with a nice steady cash inflow from a growing coke dealing business. In 1974, cocaine had become a huge scene, especially in L.A. My dad had developed a connection with an old American expatriate who brought up cocaine from Mexico. Dad bought the coke and then cut it and sold it to his clients. He wasn't selling ounces or kilos, just grams and half grams and quarter grams. But over the course of a day or two, it started to add up. He'd also moved Quaaludes. He gave a doctor a sob story about never being able to sleep, and the doc wrote a prescription for 1,000 Quaaludes, which cost maybe a quarter apiece and had a market value of $4 or $5. So between the coke and the ludes, it was a pretty lucrative business. Pops never tried to hide his drug dealing from me. He didn't go out of his way to tell me about it, but I was such a shadow to him that I'd observe all his preparations and transactions. There was a small add-on room similar to my bedroom off the kitchen. It even had a door that led to the backyard, and my dad set up shop there. The centerpiece of his drug paraphernalia in that back room was his triple beam scale, which was put to more use in our household than the toaster or the blender. His work plate and snorting tray of choice was a beautiful green and blue Mexican tile, perfectly square and flat. I'd watch him cut up the coke and strain it, and then take a brick of Italian laxative called mannitol and strain it through the same strainer so it would have the same consistency as the coke. It was important to the bottom line to make sure the coke had been cut with the proper amount of laxative. There were a lot of people coming by, but not as many as you would think. My dad was fairly surreptitious about his dealings, and he knew the risk would increase with a lot of activity. But what his clientele lacked in quantity, it sure made up for in quality. There were plenty of movie stars and TV stars and writers and rock stars and tons of girls. One time we even got a visit from two famous Oakland Raiders on the eve of the Super Bowl. They came over pretty early, about 8 or 9 p.m., and they looked a lot straighter than the usual clientele, sitting on my dad's homemade furniture and looking sheepish and unnerved by the fact that there was a kid hanging around. But it all worked out. They got their stuff, and they went out and won the Super Bowl the next day. What was kind of annoying about the whole experience was the late-night traffic. It was then that I saw the real desperation this drug could induce. I wasn't being judgmental about it. It was more like, wow, that guy really wants that damn coke. One guy who was an insatiable garbage disposal for the cocaine was the brother of a famous actor. He'd come by every hour, on the hour, until 6 in the morning, wheeling and dealing and shucking and jiving and talking long promises. Each time he knocked, my dad would get up out of bed, and I'd hear him sigh, "Oh no, not again," to himself. Sometimes my dad wouldn't even open the door. He'd just talk to people through the window screen. I'd be lying there in bed, listening to, "It's too late. Get the hell out of here. You owe me too much money anyway. You're into me for $220. My dad had a list of what people owed him. I'd look over that list and hear him say,
"If I could just get everyone to pay me what they owe me, I'd have all this money."
It was hard to convince me that we weren't living large, especially on the weekends, when my dad took me out nightclubbing, where he was known as the Lord of the Sunset Strip. He was also known as Spider, a nickname he had picked up in the late 60s when he scaled a building just to get into the apartment of a girl he was fixated on. Sunset Strip in the early 70s was the artery of life that flowed through West Hollywood. People constantly jammed the street, shuttling between the best clubs in town. There was the Whiskey-A-Go-Go and Filthy McNasty's, Two blocks from the Whiskey was the Roxy, another live music club. Across the parking lot from the Roxy was the Rainbow Bar and Grill. The Rainbow was Spider's domain. Every night he'd get there around 9 and meet up with his posse, Weaver and Connie and Bashara, and a rotating cast of characters. Getting ready for the night out was a ritualistic experience for my father, since he was so meticulous about his appearance. I'd sit there and watch him preen in front of the mirror. Every hair had to be just so, the right cologne applied in the right quantity, then the donning of the tight t-shirt and the velvet jacket and the platforms. Eventually, we'd go to custom tailors to replicate his outfits for me. It was all about mimicking my dad. Part of the ritual was getting the right high to start the night. He was obviously saving the grand finale of Chemical Cocktail for much later in the evening, but he didn't want to leave the house without the appropriate beginnings of that buzz, which usually revolved around alcohol and pills. He had Quaaludes and Placidils, which were downers that stopped you from having motor skills. When you mixed them with alcohol, they stopped the guy next to you from having motor skills. But my dad's pills of choice were Two-in-Alls. When I went out with him, he'd pour me a small glass of beer. Then he'd break open a Two-in-All capsule. Because the powder from the Two-in-Alls was so horrible tasting, he'd slice up a banana and shove the broken up Two-in-All in the banana. He'd take the part that contained more powder and give me the smaller portion. Then we were ready to go out. Our royal reception would start as soon as we walked up to the Rainbow's door. Tony, the maitre d' of the club, would greet my dad as if he were the most valued customer on the strip. Of course, the $100 bill that my dad handed him as we walked in didn't hurt. Tony would lead us to my dad's table, the power table, right in front of a huge fireplace. From that vantage point, you could see anyone who was coming in the club or walking down from over the Rainbow, a nightclub within the club. My dad was incredibly territorial. If a person who didn't pass his muster sat down at the table, Spider would just confront him. "What do you think you're doing?"
I just wanted to sit down and hang out," the guy would say.
"Sorry, pal. Out of here. You gotta go."
But if someone came in who was of interest to my father, he'd jump up and arrange seating. His policing of the table made me uncomfortable. I didn't necessarily want interlopers to sit down, but I thought my dad could have been kinder and gentler. Especially when the booze and the downers were flowing at the same time, he could be an asshole. But he was a great catalyst for getting interesting people together. If Keith Moon, or the guys from Led Zeppelin, or Alice Cooper was in town, they'd be sitting with Spider, because he was the coolest guy in the house. We'd be at the Rainbow most of the night. He didn't stay at the table the whole time, just long enough for his anchors to arrive to hold down the table, and then they'd all take turns making the rounds within the restaurant bar area, or going upstairs. I always loved the upstairs club. Whenever one of my dad's girlfriends would want to dance, she'd ask me, because Spider was not a dancer. The night wouldn't be complete without cocaine, and it became a great sport to see how clandestinely you could consume your blow. The experienced coke hounds were easy to spot, because they all had the right pinky coke fingernail. They'd grow that pinky at least a good half inch past the finger and shape it perfectly, and that was the ultimate coke spoon of the time. My dad took great pride in his elaborately manicured coke nail. But I also noticed that one of his nails was decidedly shorter than the rest. "What's up with that one?" I asked.
"Well, that's so I don't hurt the ladies down below when I'm using my finger on them," he said. Boy, that stuck in my mind. He actually had a finger that was pussy-friendly.
I was the only child present for all this insanity. For the most part, the adults who didn't know me just ignored me. But Keith Moon, the legendary drummer for The Who, always tried to make me feel at ease. In the midst of this chaotic, riotous, party-life atmosphere, where everyone was screaming and shouting and sniffing and snorting and drinking and humping, Moon would take the time to be still and take me under his arm and say,
"How you doing, kid? You having a good time? Shouldn't you be at school or something? Well, I'm glad you're here anyway."
That always stuck with me.
We'd usually stay until closing time, which was 2 a.m. Then it was time to congregate in the parking lot, which had filled up with girls and boys in their outlandish glam rock clothing. The parking lot scene was all about getting phone numbers and bird-dogging and finding the after-party. But sometimes it was the scene of an altercation that oftentimes involved my dad. He'd take on biker gangs in front of me, and I'd be the little guy jumping into the middle of these scraps going, "This is my dad. He's really wasted right now. Whatever he said, just go ahead and forgive him. He didn't mean it. And please, don't hit him in the face, because it really hurts a kid like me to see his dad get hit in the face."
I did have a horrible feeling that my dad would end up hurting himself badly in a fight or in a car accident. At that point in the night, he'd be so high that walking across the room was a vaudevillian routine of a guy stumbling, falling down, and somehow managing to stay up on his feet. He'd be bouncing off furniture, holding on to anything that was stable, slurring every word, but still, he'd try to get into the car to drive to the party. I'd be, oh shit, my dad can't talk. This is not good.